The headlines: Iran warns it will respond immediately to any move against it by the U.S. and its allies at the International Atomic Energy Agency. The Israeli Prime Minister steps up his rhetoric against Iran as the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency visits Israel. And also, the war in Ukraine enters its 100th day, with Russian forces pressing ahead with their offensive to take more areas in the eastern Donbass region. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's foreign minister says his country will immediately respond to any anti-Tehran move by the United States and its allies at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Hossein Amir Abdullahian censured the, quote, hasty and destructive move by Washington and the three European countries, namely Britain, France, and Germany, in compiling a draft resolution at the IAEA. He said such a behavior goes against diplomacy and will complicate the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal between Iran and the world powers. Amir Abdullahian reiterated Iran's willingness to reach a good, strong, and lasting deal. He made the remarks in a phone call with EU Foreign Affairs Chief Josep Borrell. Well, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, is on a visit to Israel, where he has met with Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. Iran has been a main topic of their talks. No images have been released from the meeting. Israel has issued a statement saying it prefers diplomacy on Iran's nuclear program. But the statement added Israel will take action if the international community fails to stop the program within, quote, the relevant time frame. The rhetoric comes despite repeated warnings by Iran against any Israeli act of aggression. Bennett has hosted Grossi 4 days ahead of an IAEA Board of Governors meeting on Iran. Britain, France, and Germany, all parties to the 2015 Iran deal, plan to present a resolution urging more cooperation from Tehran. The U.S. has voiced support for the resolution.
And we can confirm that we plan to join the UK, France, and Germany in seeking a resolution focused on the need for Iran to fully cooperate with the IAEA. It is essential that Iran does fully comply with its legally binding obligations under the NPT and separately with its comprehensive safeguard agreement with the IAEA without further delay.
Tehran has already warned against any unconstructive action. At the Monday meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors, it has promised a strong and proportionate response. Iran has time and again said that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. The country says it's a signatory to the International Non-Proliferation Treaty, criticizing Israel for refusing to join the agreement. The latest developments come as talks over the revival of the 2015 Iran deal await a final decision. Tehran says Washington should make that decision. The 2015 accord ran into trouble after the U.S. withdrew from it 4 years ago. Cooperation between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency is under the spotlight as the agency's Board of Governors prepares for an upcoming meeting. As we'll see in this next report, the outcome of the meeting is tied to the stalled talks between Iran and the P4 Plus One group to revive the JCPOA.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, is supposed to monitor compliance with the 1968 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The NPT has been described as a centerpiece of global efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, promote cooperation in the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and to achieve the goal of nuclear disarmament. The IAEA is supposed to have technical and professional cooperation with NPT signatories away from politics. The Atomic Agency has had a high-profile role regarding Iran's nuclear energy program. In 2015, when Iran and the P5 Plus One struck a deal known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the IAEA was tasked with monitoring Iran's compliance with the terms of the agreement. In many of its reports over the past years, the agency has said that it has found no evidence of any diversion in Iran's nuclear program. As the fate of the faltering 2015 deal remains increasingly unclear, the technical role and supposed independence of the atomic watchdog are being tested. In a recent report, the IAEA said Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium had grown to more than 18 times the limit allowed in the 2015 agreement. The agency also said Iran has failed to answer its remaining questions. Tehran described the IAEA's latest statements as one-sided, saying that it fails to reflect Iran's extensive cooperation with the agency.
The International Atomic Energy Agency seems to be succumbing to the same sort of takeover that the United States and the Anglo-Zionist Empire has been doing to so many other international organizations, such as, for example, in athletics, for example, in economics with the World Economic Forum, for example. All these organizations, they seem to want to control them.
Meanwhile, reports say Western countries lobbied by Israel are planning to push the International Atomic Energy Agency to criticize Iran at its upcoming meeting of the Board of Governors.
And Iran has repeatedly warned that the IAEA's work must remain technical and away from politics. This week, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian warned against any political interference in the technical affairs of the agency, stressed the need for avoiding political approaches in the forthcoming Board of Governors meeting. This as Israel has stepped up its campaign to get the West on board to pile pressure on Iran.
Back in March, Rafael Grossi, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, visited Iran. The IAEA and Iran announced at the end of the visit that they had agreed on an approach for resolving remaining bilateral issues. The visit came as representatives from Iran and the P4+1 were trying to find a way to move forward in their negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. The talks are currently stalled, with Iran saying the United States is failing to make necessary political decisions. At this point, any stance by the Atomic Agency could have an important effect on the stalled talks. This week, Iran's top diplomat said Tehran and the agency's agreement in March was mutually satisfactory. He warned that political interference in the technical affairs of the agency is totally unconstructive. Amir Abdollahian's comments came ahead of a meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors scheduled for June the 6th. Days left to the meeting, the IAEA chief has arrived in Israel after Tel Aviv released documents alleging Iran spied on the IAEA. Iran says Israel, which has refused to join the NPT and is believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, hates the JCPOA and wants to derail the effort to revive it.
The problem with much of what the International Atomic Energy Agency has been doing is that it is trying to find excuses to make out that the Iranian nuclear program is a military program. And one of the problems with the IAEA is they're not looking anywhere near as closely at the Israelis, who do have nuclear weapons. They tried to keep it secret, but Mordecai Vanunu blew the whistle in the Sunday Times here in Britain back in the 1980s and did a massive jail term when he was kidnapped, actually, for his trouble. That they do have many nuclear weapons, probably something like 200, they say.
Reports say the United States and its Western allies, pushed by Israel, plan to pile pressure on Iran at the upcoming IAEA meeting. Tehran has warned that it would respond firmly and appropriately to any such move because Tehran has been cooperating based on the agreement reached in March. The fate of months of negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 seems to be at stake as a meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors draws close. Who would benefit from a possible collapse of the talks?
Israel presses ahead with its settlement expansion on Palestinian land. The regime has reportedly approved construction of 820 new settler units in occupied Al-Quds. Palestinian media said the plan is in two phases. The regime will build 130 units in the first phase and 490 in the second. The new plan comes less than a month after Israel approved 4,400 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. That was the biggest number in settlement construction plans since President Joe Biden took office in the White House. The move met widespread condemnation in Palestine and by the international community. The UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process has urged Israel to halt its settlement activities, saying they are a major obstacle to peace. All the settlements are illegal under international law. And Yemenis have filled the streets in various cities, including the northwestern city of Saada, to protest against the continued Saudi-led aggression against their country. Demonstrations taking place in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Demonstrators chanted slogans against Riyadh. They also chanted death to America, condemning the U.S. for supporting Saudi Arabia in the ongoing war. The conflict began 7 years ago. The U.N. says that hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed directly or through indirect causes such as hunger. The world body says Yemen is now the world's biggest humanitarian crisis. Numerous ceasefires meant to ease civilian sufferings have failed in the past years. The latest truce took effect in April this year, but Yemenis have complained about repeated violations by Saudi Arabia. Streets of the Yemeni capital Sana'a are packed now as people are holding anti-U.S., anti-Saudi regimes, also chanting anti-Saudi rallies, also chanting anti-Israeli regime slogans as well, denouncing the Saudi-led war on Yemen and the continued support by the likes of the United States and its allies. Moving on, the war in Ukraine is entering its 100th day, with Russian forces now tightening their grip on the eastern Donbass region. The situation is tense in the city of Severodonetsk. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Severodonetsk and nearby communities are the hardest hit. He also says about 1/5 of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea and parts of Donbass, seized in 2014 and are now under Russian control. Zelensky has called on his Western allies to supply more weapons. Russian forces are fighting Ukrainians in the south as well. At least one person has been killed and several others injured in Russian shelling in the city of Mykolaiv. That's according to Ukrainian officials. Our correspondent Johnny Miller earlier joined us from Donetsk province in eastern Ukraine with details on the situation there. Let's take a listen.
President Zelensky said a couple of days ago that between 60 and 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying every day in the Donbass, which is a staggering number if that's true. Russia, of course, has air and artillery superiority. The Donetsk People's Republic said that they will complete their encirclement of troops around Severodonetsk and Lysychansk in the next 3 days. So it's really troublesome times for the Ukrainian military. I've also heard reports that some Ukrainian soldiers tried to retreat from Severodonetsk, but they're sent back by their commanders to try and make a stand. The Ukrainians have tried to ask NATO, particularly America, for more heavy artillery. That's what they think they need in order to stop the Russian advances. But it's very hard for the Americans to get their heavy weapons even to the front. Russia is hitting railways and weapons depots all over Ukraine. Yesterday they hit a major tunnel in the Lvov district, which is where many of the weapons have been able to get in, a major railway tunnel. So it's very difficult for these weapons to even get to the front. And if they do get to the front, they're a target for Russian air and artillery themselves.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman says China's challenging Europe's security, economy, and values. Sherman says China's actions matter for the future of Europe. She called on the continent to help the U.S. counter competition from Beijing. The U.S. diplomat also said her country remains vigilant over China's partnership with Russia. She added China will see consequences if it sends military equipment to Russia. Beijing in the past has denied such claims. It has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop smearing China's domestic and foreign policies. One such call just came last Friday when Beijing hit back at a speech by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He'd accused China of seeking to reshape the world order. Political commentator Andrew Loing says Europe needs to take a cautious approach towards China, considering its trading partnership with Beijing.
Of course, the Europe wants the U.S. wants Europe to be on its side against China. As I said, that there are commonalities as far as values, Western values, are concerned. But after all, China is Europe's largest trading partner and is the center of the global supply and value chain. And so Europe does not necessarily want to push the envelope too far, let alone starting a direct war with China. After all, the competition between China and the United States is not military. It's in the field of economics. And China is now the second largest economy in the world, soon to overtake the United States as perhaps the world's largest. So I think that Europe is likely to adopt more nuanced kind of approach.
More people falling victim to gun violence in the U.S., where calls are growing for tighter control on carrying arms. In the latest incident, a man shot dead two women in a parking lot of a church in Iowa. He then turned the gun on himself. In Wisconsin, two people were injured after a man opened fire at a funeral. The shooter is now at large. The Thursday incidents are the latest in a series of shootings that have rocked the U.S. in the past weeks. President Joe Biden has now called on Congress to take action and impose tougher gun control measures.
We need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And if we can't ban assault weapons, then we should raise the age to purchase them from 18 to 21, strengthen background checks, enact safe storage law and red flag laws, repeal the immunity that protects gun manufacturers from liability, address the mental health crisis, deepening the trauma of gun violence and as a consequence of that violence. These are rational, common-sense measures.
Biden's proposed measures have historically been blocked by Republicans in Congress. Gun safety advocates have pushed the president to take stronger measures on his own to curb gun violence, but the White House wants Congress to pass legislation. Just 2 weeks ago, an 18-year-old opened fire at an elementary school in Texas, killing 21, many of them children. An independent research group called Gun Violence Archive has registered at least 230 mass shootings in the U.S. so far this year. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
New data shows mystifying lack of progress by the UK's fishing industry in post-Brexit pledge to curb bottom trawling, 2 years after a landmark legislation. We're prepared for you an article written by Karen McVeigh. The piece is titled "Fishing Industry Still Bulldozing Seabed in 90% of UK Marine Protected Areas." According to data shared with The Guardian, more than 90% of Britain's offshore marine protected areas are still being bottom trawled and dredged, 2 years after analysis of the extent of destructive fishing exposed them as paper parks. The UK's network of marine parks set up to safeguard vulnerable areas of the seabed and marine life is a cornerstone of the government's target to purportedly protect 30% of ocean biodiversity by 2030. But analysis of fishing vessel tracking data from Global Fishing Watch and Oceana a conservation non-governmental organization, found that fishing with bottom-towed gear took place last year on 58 out of 64 offshore benthic MPAs, which aim to protect species that live on the seabed. It found a total of 1,604 vessels, including industrial boats, spent 132,267 fishing hours in these marine protected areas in the United Kingdom. Vessels with bottom-towed gear, the most destructive type of fishing vessel, involving dragging weighted nets across seafloor habitats, spent at least 31,854 hours in marine protected areas in 2021. Oceana, the non-governmental organization, said this is likely to be an underestimate, as it could only identify gear type for 837 boats, just over half of those detected, due to a lack of publicly available data. It said the vast majority were industrial vessels. When vessels with bottom-towed gear fish in marine parks, it prevents the recovery of ecosystems already lost to decades of exploitation and limits the seabed's ability to store carbon and combat the effects of the climate crisis. Greenpeace has described this type of fishing in marine protected areas as akin to bulldozing national parks. Bottom trawling is banned in just 2 marine protected areas to date, with another 4 to be protected in June. Melissa Moore, head of UK policy at Oceana in Europe, said that Oceana's analysis is further proof that this damaging activity is pervasive. Yet still, the UK and devolved governments have licensed this to occur throughout 2022 as well, contravening nature laws. They are destroying habitats for the future. Post-Brexit, the United Kingdom has granted licenses for thousands of vessels to fish in all UK waters, including in all but 2 offshore marine protected areas. Melissa Moore said no other activities, not houses, roads or ports, are licensed first and assessed later. She added, "Yet this is what happens with fishing. Despite the law being clear that you must not license activities until it has been proven, they do not have an adverse effect on the site." The offshore habitats regulations say no activities can be licensed on special areas of conservation unless an assessment confirms they will not adversely affect site integrity. In April, after Oceana and other groups raised legal concerns, the British government committed to adopting fisheries management for all of its marine protected areas by 2024. The United Kingdom has had powers to ban bottom trawling in marine protected areas since Brexit via the 2020 Fisheries Act. 2 years later, no bans are in place, although on 13th of June, new laws to outlaw the practice in 4 marine protected areas come into effect. These include Dogger Bank, a vital North Sea breeding ground for commercial species including cod and whiting, as well as sand eels, eaten by kittiwakes, puffins and porpoises. It is also an important site for blue carbon, the carbon dioxide sequestered and stored in coastal and marine ecosystems. The 4 marine protected areas represent a tenth of offshore marine protected areas, leaving 90% unprotected. Last month, the government announced that a further 13 are being examined as part of its post-Brexit freedoms to protect rare and valuable marine habitats and species. But non-governmental organizations damned the government's plans as too slow, unambitious, and unlikely to deliver its 2030 target to protect 30% of the ocean. They say introducing license conditions to all industrial vessels, banning them from fishing in marine protected areas, would allow faster and better protection. Charles Clover, executive director of the Blue Marine Foundation, said, "The government was under an obligation to protect these areas on day one of Brexit. They are so far behind in compliance with their own laws. It is mystifying, and it makes them vulnerable to legal challenges." Will McCallum of Greenpeace said, "It's taken 2 years for the government to introduce trawling bans on 4 marine protected areas. The whole thing is taking too long, and at the end, you have a ban on a single gear type, bottom-towed gear, but in theory, a super trawler could go straight through it." A spokesperson for Britain's Department of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs claimed, "It is untrue to say that little has changed. We have passed our Landmark Fisheries Act 2020. We are consulting on the Joint Fisheries Statement. We are stopping damaging trawling and dredging in 4 marine protected areas. And we have asked for evidence to support the management of 13 further marine protected area sites. Our £100 million UK Seafood Fund is supporting innovation and sustainability to ensure that our fisheries sector is the most sustainable in the world." UK Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs is expected to consult soon on highly protected marine areas, defined as areas which allow for the protection and recovery of marine habitats by banning destructive fishing methods. A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "The Scottish Government is committed to designating highly protected marine areas covering at least 10% of Scotland's inshore and offshore waters by 2026, before the end of the current Scottish parliamentary term. This is a world-leading commitment. It means the European Union 10% target, but in a shorter time frame." The Scottish Government spokesperson added, "The highly protected marine areas will prohibit all extractive, destructive, depositional activities and allow other activities only at non-damaging levels. We have committed to delivering fisheries management measures for existing marine protected areas, where these are not already in place, by March of 2024 at the latest."
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: عظم العالم لعلمه ودع منازعته، وصغر الجاهل لجهله ولا تطرده، ولكن قربه وعلمه.
Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam stated, venerate the scholar for his knowledge and abandon argumentation with him. Depreciate the ignorant man for his ignorance, but do not drive him away. Rather, draw him near and teach him.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful conversations and the beautiful lessons that we learn in the dialogues and the conversations of the divinely appointed imams, of course we come across the conversations and the dialogues of the divinely appointed imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. In one instance, we find that Imam al-Kadhim answered a question from one of his companions. And in reply to this question of the companion of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, who had asked him about some general directions, these kind of guidelines for life from the Imam alayhi salam really replied in a beautiful and eloquent and concise manner, a manner which is constant and is repeated in the behaviors and the speaking style of all of the divinely appointed imams and the Holy Prophet Muhammad, a peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. So in reply, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, the passage of time is a lesson. Now here, of course, we kind of are able to take two different views upon this subject. One is that through the passage of time, you learn a great many lessons. Now, if we are to give this possibility that this is what is meant here by the Imam in this conversation, in this dialogue, well, it's true. We need to stop and think about the different lessons that occur within our life and learn from those lessons. But another interpretation which can be taken from this statement is that the passage of time itself is a lesson. And so here, of course, you know, one who realizes that time is passing, and not only is time passing, but time is passing incredibly quickly, and time does not come back. Once it goes by, it does not return. Then we realize what lesson from this idea of the passage of time, this lesson that time is incredibly valuable, and we must use our time very, very wisely and use our time for the benefit of the hereafter, which is our ultimate and end
goal and our final resting place. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imama of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. The general public, upset with the conditions they're in, wanting change, they were rallied up in the wrong ways by Banu Abbas and people that were connected to them, and opportunists and commanders in the field through ignorance, through various elements, led to the government of Banu Abbas instead of the overthrow of the government of Umayyads, which was a movement initiated, continued, established by the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet, the Imams, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in. It was misled, it was corrupted, and it ended up establishing. It removed the Umayyads, but instead of establishing the government for the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet, as he had mentioned, it established government for Banu Abbas. And they became ruthless rulers that were in many ways arguably worse than the Umayyads, although in some ways, in some areas perhaps, the ruthlessness of the Umayyads was unmatched even by the Abbasids, but in certain other ways, for certain other people, for the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in, the ruthlessness of the Abbasids was definitely worse than that of the Umayyads, and for reasons that if we put two together, we'll be able to see.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The number of evictions sought by landlords is climbing back to pre-pandemic levels in cities across the U.S. as wage growth continues to lag behind inflation and millions of people struggle with the rising cost of basic necessities. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Mike Ludwig, journalist. This article is published under the heading Evictions are climbing to pre-pandemic levels in cities across the U.S. Here's the story. The number of evictions sought by landlords is climbing back to pre-pandemic levels in cities across the U.S. as wage growth continues to lag behind inflation and millions of people struggle with the rising cost of basic necessities. An estimated 35% of respondents to U.S. Census Bureau's latest household Paul survey said they are either very or somewhat likely to leave their home in the next 2 months due to an eviction. Only about 11% said they applied for and received rental assistance through federally funded programs, typically administered by states and cities, which are charged with distributing around $46.5 billion in aid to landlords and tenants. A larger Paul survey found that nearly 25% of renter households are slightly confident or not confident at all in their ability to pay the next month's rent. These federal figures are just estimates extrapolated from surveys, but if they are anywhere close to reality, a growing wave of evictions could displace millions of people as the cost of living spikes. Until recently, employment gains and support from temporary pandemic aid packages shielded the working class from the harms of inflation, according to Sean Fresmed, a senior policy fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. However, corporations continue to raise prices on consumers, and Congress failed to extend safety net programs such as the expanded child tax credit that kept millions of people from going hungry last year. He said in a statement recently, but it is now clear that corporate greed is hitting the working class head on. According to the Census Bureau, just over one in three adults, about 34%, now report difficulty paying for the usual household expenses, the highest level we've seen since early 2021. Across the six states and 31 cities tracked by Princeton University's Eviction Lab, landlords filed for more than 10,247 evictions in the last week alone. In Texas cities, Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth, landlords filed for 37,000 evictions in the first 3 months of the year, according to a Texas Tribune report based on the same data. In Dallas, eviction filings plummeted during the height of the pandemic to as few as six per week, but filings skyrocketed after local and federal eviction moratoriums were lifted months ago. More than 1,000 filings were recorded in Dallas during 1 week this month alone. Similar reports are surfacing in cities across the country as pandemic social aid dries up. And the housing crisis goes beyond eviction, thanks in part to a broken social safety net and low wages for workers across multiple top industries. Nearly one in three U.S. households can only afford to pay $600 in rent per month or less, resulting in many families grappling with crowded or dangerous housing conditions. The United States was facing a housing and eviction crisis long before the pandemic forced businesses to shut down and put millions of people out of work. Even before the pandemic, many were charged rent they could not afford, according to housing justice groups. Prior to 2020, more than 3.6 million evictions were filed each year in the U.S. Falling behind on rent can be a slippery slope toward losing a home, especially in red states with few legal protections for renters. When facing an eviction, only about 3% of tenants are represented by an attorney compared to about 81% of landlords, according to the National Coalition on the Civil Rights to Counsel. However, many evictions are never even challenged in court, according to John Polak, his staff attorney at the coalition. They just leave. If they try to fight alone, they will lose, and they know it, Polak said in an interview, adding, half of the people involved don't even go to court for something that can make them homeless, lose their children, lose their job. Even the filing of an eviction, regardless of the outcome in court, can remain on a tenant's record for years. The burdens of this crisis are extremely uneven. From 2012 to 2016, black tenants on average were served eviction notices from landlords at nearly twice the rate of white renters, and low-income black women were disproportionately targeted, according to the American Civil Liberties Union. Fortunately, Polak said, concerns about housing during the pandemic have amplified efforts in multiple cities to guarantee tenants the right to legal representation and set up eviction diversion programs that aim to resolve disputes between tenants and landlords with the goal of preventing an eviction hearing in court. Tenants' unions have also organized to collectively challenge landlords and fight evictions across the country. Washington State, Maryland, and Connecticut established right-to-counsel programs that provide legal counsel to tenants facing eviction based on income. And similar programs were recently established in New York City, San Francisco, Newark, Boulder, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Louisville, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Toledo, Seattle, Denver, and Cleveland, according to Polak. There are now 16 jurisprudences that have right to counsel. There were zero in 2017, Polak said. Other cities attempt to thwart an eviction crisis by passing new protections for renters, but Polak said these efforts suffer from enforcement problems. Often tenants have to file an affidavit of some kind. They don't know how to do it, and landlords can challenge it, Polak said, adding, in the cities that don't have a right to counsel, some of the eviction diversion programs and other efforts have helped, but sometimes they are hampered by the fact that there are no lawyers there to make sure that laws are actually followed. Even in cities where tenants have a right to counsel, the infrastructure behind many of the new programs is still being built. Polak said there are shortages of defense attorneys for tenants across the U.S. A federal moratorium on evictions was thrown out by the Supreme Court last August, and most local moratoriums have expired. Local courts are filing with tenants facing eviction, with in-person hearings replacing the onerous Zoom calls that previously slowed court proceedings and locked out defendants without internet access during pandemic lockdowns. Still, advocates know a right to counsel can keep many people in their homes. In New York City, 84% of tenants with legal representation stay in their homes. In Cleveland, 93% of represented tenants avoid an eviction or involuntary move, according to Polak. Many tenants are unable to appear in court due to work, family, and other obligations during daytime. In cities without a right to counsel, these tenants are often forced out of their homes without a chance to assert their rights. Legal representation from right to counsel programs instantly fixes that problem, with attorneys appearing in court and filing paperwork on behalf of tenants. Pollock said advocates are encouraging more law students to become tenants' attorneys in hopes of building a pipeline from graduate law schools to state and local programs that guarantee legal defense for tenants. Pollock said, "We view this as a cutting-edge civil rights fight, which it is. We view this as part of the fight for the right to housing."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
me a piece, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very noble tradition and hadith, which has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. This hadith is regarding the characteristics and the noble traits of the Shia and the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. You know, a lot of us consider ourselves Shia, but we don't really know what Shia are and how they should be. If we were to know the characteristics of the Shia, you know, as they have been narrated in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, we might not consider ourselves to be really be Shia. In this tradition, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam once asked a man about his tribe and brothers, meaning his Shia brothers, whom he had left back at home. When the Imam asked this person this, the latter, meaning this person, replied by praising them and attesting to their integrity and extolling them. Meaning this person said, yes, my brothers in back home and in my tribe, they're great people, they're Shia, they love you, they're your followers. You know, I attest to their integrity, their sincerity with you. The Imam said, oh, really? The Imam asked him the following. He said, do the rich among them visit the poor when they are ill? So those brothers that you're talking about, those Shia brothers who are rich, you know, who are rich and have a lot of wealth, when they hear that a poor Shia is ill and sick, does this person go and visit him? Or not? Or did he just sit home? Is he afraid that if he visits this poor Shia who's ill, the poor person will ask him for money and then he'll have be forced to give him money for his, you know, to get better, to go buy money, to go buy his medicine, or not? When the Imam asked this person this, he replied in the following way: not much, meaning our rich don't really visit the ill, who are poor when they are ill. Then the Imam said, do the rich frequent the poor at all? Meaning not even when they're poor, not even when they're ill, but do they at least go and visit them, you know, when they're healthy? The Imam replied, no, not much. So the Imam asked, then do the rich,